So I'm very pleased to have convinced an eminent biologist to come to talk to us, theoretical physicists, about sex and death. Now, almost all the physicists I know of are interested in death, and quite a few are also interested in sex. And so I thought it would be appropriate to have the last ITP colloquium of the millennium. So may the ITP last another millennium. To the last colloquium on the theory of death, and in particular the connection of death to the invention of sexual reproduction. In reading popular biology books over the years, I learned that death is one of the unsolved problems of biology. So I was very fortunate to stumble on Professor William Clark's books last year, which I have here, Sex and the Origin of Death, and A Means to an End, both of which I recommend very highly. Bill Clark is not only a highly distinguished scientist, but also an exceptionally lucid writer with a subtle sense of humor. I enjoy both books enormously. So without taking up any more time, I present to you Bill Clark.
Thanks for having me here. I'm very impressed in a biology seminar that you're just now beginning to take. I have to be showing up in the auditorium. So,
or you like to, or how do you do this? See, it's already with the mechanism.
There. Okay.
In my pocket. All right. Does that work? Is that better? I have no idea. All right. So, could somebody flip on that projector there? Right. We'll start with a question that I started with when I began ruminating about this whole thing. Why death? I mean, death's really kind of a downer. I mean, where did it come from? Evolutionarily, we think of evolution as selecting for very positive things. Why would evolution have selected for something like death? Is death necessary? Could we get along just as well without death? I mean, what are the biological driving rationales for something like death? What we're really asking, in a sense, is what is death? We have to start out with that question. That's a no-brainer. Death is when you're dead, right? Okay, it's not that simple. It's a very complicated question. If you get into things like something like, let's say, the persistent vegetative state, where somebody goes into one of these interminable comas, you have a body lying on a bed, which is breathing, which is taking in food, which is secreting waste products, pink and healthy looking. But there's nothing associated with that body that we would think of as a person in the human sense. There's no memory, there's no thought, there's no feeling, no emotion. It can't be obnoxious. Many other things that we associate with being a human being. What happens if you kill somebody like that? Can you be convicted of murder? I can tell you that that's been before the courts in any number of instances. So it's a very complicated thing. Parts of the body can be dead. Is the person dead? So I think as scientists, we'd like to get to some sort of definition of death that we could deal with in a semi-quantitative fashion. Get away from human definitions. And I want to tell you about very briefly about an experiment carried out by a guy named Hal Horwitz, who's a biophysicist at Yale, some 30-odd years ago. This involves brine shrimp. Brine shrimp are these things that live up, for example, in San Francisco Bay. And at one stage in the life cycle of a brine shrimp, it produces eggs and embryos, and the embryos start to develop. Now, if the embryos get stuck off in a tide pool somewhere and the water evaporates so that the conditions become inconsistent with further life, instead of just giving up the ghost and dying, they go into a state which has been called cryptobiosis. And there are many different forms of cryptobiosis, but the salient feature of this is that it's a state where you simply cannot measure life in any form, any way that we know of to detect life. You cannot detect life in these things. And these brine shrimp become very dry and hard. They get rid of all the water from their cells. But the critical thing is, if you now take these dried out brine shrimp and you throw them back into fresh water, Within a few hours, they rejuvenate. They start wiggling around. They go ahead and develop into full-blown adult brine shrimp, and they in turn reproduce their own kind, et cetera, et cetera. So it's a very fascinating, very useful. I mean, you feed your fish, your goldfish. You can buy them in the store on the shelf. You get these little boxes that are full of these dry, hard, rattly things, and you dump them in your water, and next thing you know, you have a wonderful supply of food for your fish. But it's this ability to come back to life or to rejuvenate that's fascinating. Now, Hal Morowitz was very interested in this phenomenon, and he did a very simple experiment, which is not at all appreciated by biologists, and I hope physicists will appreciate the experiment. He just took some of these brine shrimp that had gone into this cryptobiotic state, and he divided them into two pots. One pot he just let sit at room temperature, and the other pot he took down to about 2.2 degrees Kelvin. Why is that funny now? Okay. What did I say? It's a dumb experiment, right? I see. Okay. Anyway, the technology of the time let him get down to about 2 degrees Kelvin. And he just took him down there. He left him for 6 days. And he brought him back up, gradually thawed them back out, threw them both into water, and he got equivalent survival. And the biologists completely miss the fascinating part of this experiment. Here are some of his conclusions. He says, at these temperatures, the only feature of the organism that's maintained is its structure. While each atom retains its position at 2.2 Kelvin, more or less retains its position, its momentum goes very close to zero. And all the information required for life must therefore have been stored in its structure. The fact that these things can be resuscitated suggests that all the information necessary for whatever it is that we call life had to have been stored in the structure of these organisms. So argues against the, actually still had these arguments about vital principles. I mean, biologists used to believe in vital principles up until the 60s. But I think this experiment certainly deep sixes that sort of thing. And so you can say that the possibility of life can be defined as the interaction of energy, presumably just ambient thermodynamic energy, with specified biological macromolecules arranged in specified structure. Death then becomes the disruption of that interaction. Okay? And so in living color, we can say that life is the interaction of precisely ordered molecular structure with ambient thermal energy, which in turn allows the utilization of stored energy to reproduce DNA. And death then must become, as I just said, the disruption of that interaction. Now, further little refinements on what we call life would be that. I want you guys to do this experiment all the way down to a Bose-Einstein condensate, see? Then we're going to really, really take care of this argument about structure. I have no idea. Yeah. 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 He's a biophysicist, not a physicist. So he's probably doing the best he could at the time. I don't know why. He wanted to go as far down. He wanted to take momentum as close to zero as he could get. So that he could really pin this thing to structure and nothing else. Yes, sure. But people identify more with things that wiggle and boogie and, you know, nobody would read the paper if it was about plant seeds. Well, some additional things that we need to put on to the definition of life and sort of the standard biological definition of life is that it has to be something which can extract additional energy from its surroundings in the form of food, energy that's been stored in the form of food, or in the case of plants, actually extracting additional thermodynamic energy from the environment. It has to be able to extract energy from the environment in an active, not just a passive way. Has to be able to use that energy to do work. And, of course, with living organisms, the main work that they do is to perpetuate their own DNA, to pass their own genes on to the next generation. That's sort of really the bottom line of biology. So how does this happen, this death business? How does this productive interaction of structure and energy come about, and why. That's always going to be the bottom line here. Now, biologists, being reductionists at heart, would approach this by saying, what's the smallest thing of which we can say this is alive? And the reason that's going to be important is because if it's the smallest thing that can be alive, it's also the smallest thing that can be dead, right? Or that can die, that can make the transition from life to death. That certainly would be cells. Cells are, we think of them as sort of the atoms of life, although even atoms, as we know, are not at all indivisible. Viruses are not alive by any definition that a biologist would use. They're not alive. They cannot on their own extract energy from the environment. They can't reproduce themselves, and you know, so they're not alive. They have, by infecting another cell and using parts of another cell, they can reproduce themselves, but not autonomously. I didn't put that little qualifier in at the other. You have to be able to extract energy, do work, and reproduce autonomously to be considered alive. So anyway, that's all important because if we understand how a cell, an individual cell, and we're all made of individual cells, if we understand how an individual cell makes that transition from a state that we all recognize as being alive to a state that we all agree is dead, that's probably going to tell us something about how we ourselves go through that transition. Because all death of individuals like ourselves begins with the deaths of single cells. Now, the question for a biologist becomes then, how do cells die? And there's two ways. There's two ways that we can think of death. There's two kinds of death, both at the organismal level and later at the cellular level. Yeah. You just have to look through me as you look at the screen. There's accidental death, and then something that we generally put under the heading of senescence or natural death or any of a variety of other terms. For multicellular organisms, accidental death means being eaten by a predator, for example, getting hit by a car, falling off a cliff, and many, many other possible ways of dying. But the key thing to keep in mind here is that what we're calling accidental death is due to causes outside the organism, external to the organism. Okay, that's accidental death. The other kind of death, natural death, from idiopathic, that's internally generated disease, etc. That's what happens if you manage to escape death by accident. This is what eventually gets you. Now, senescence and aging, progressive deterioration of the organism also makes you more susceptible to accidental death. I mean, you run slower, you get caught more easily by a predator, or you pile your car up on the freeway somewhere because your reflexes are not what they used to be. So, but if you never, it doesn't matter. If you still manage to escape accidental death, obviously we all die, and that's where we're going. Why does that happen? Why is what obvious? Do you know anybody to whom it didn't happen? I mean, that's another lecture. We'll talk about the future at another lecture. Now, the same thing happens to cells. Individual cells can die accidentally. If you smack a cell with a hammer, it's going to be dead. There's no doubt about it. If you blast it with a blowtorch, it's going to be dead. But there was nothing wrong with that cell that led to its death. It was an external cause of death. But at the same time, if you take our cells, any of our cells, and put them in culture and treat them as well as you can and totally keep them from accident, they will eventually age and die in culture. So this is what we're really talking about, not accidental death, but we're much more interested in this death from the cumulative of causes of senescence. So again, it's always this internal cause versus external cause. We're going to be interested in the internal cause. We want to know what are those internal causes and where do they come from and what role do they serve in biology. So it's probably been a while since you've had freshman biology, so I just thought I'd go over just a little bit here about the structure of the cell. Our cells, animal cells, like plant cells, have a nucleus where the DNA is stored. DNA, as you know, contains all the genes that basically, in a sense, is a hologram of the organism because all of the instructions necessary for the creation and operation of a human being, for example, is stored in that DNA. That's the secret behind cloning. You can the information is still there. You can pull the information out and, under certain circumstances, actually reproduce the entire organism. As we were saying at lunch, a little interesting little factoid that many people don't think about is that every single cell in its nucleus has 2 meters of DNA. It's very tightly supercoiled and compacted, but there's 2 meters in there. There are 10 to the 14th cells in you and me. So any one of you has 2 times 10 to the 14th meters of DNA, which goes around the Earth about 3 million times, which is totally useless but interesting fact. Always fascinates me. Well, anyway, the point I just wanted to make here is that the inside of a cell from an animal like us is a very, very complicated thing. It's full of what we call organelles, which is, just means little organs. I mean, we have livers and kidneys and lungs and things like that. And cells also have a variety of internal organelles, highly specialized. The nucleus itself is an organelle. There's this endoplasmic reticulum here, which is where proteins are made. These little black dots are ribosomes, which are sort of the little workbenches where proteins are assembled. Very important are these mitochondria. Mitochondria are where sugar and oxygen are burned together to produce energy. You produce ATP, which is sort of the universal currency of energy inside of living cells. ATP is made here at the mitochondria. Somewhere in here, there's lysosomes. These are basically little trash compactors where all the mistakes that the cell makes are shunted over to and destroyed. Food coming in is partially digested here in these lysosomes. And so that's just a very fast look at, because I'm going to show you a simpler cell in a minute, and just bear in mind that animal cells, such as we're made of, are extraordinarily complex. So the way a cell like this would die accidentally inside of a human being, let's say, for example, if you had one of these sludge-filled blood vessels leading to a section of your heart, the feeding myocardial cells, all right, and it gets clogged up as we know through atherosclerosis. What happens is that cuts off the supply of sugar and oxygen through the bloodstream to a section of heart, and all of those cells that were served by that blood vessel now go into a state called ischemia. And what it really means is that the sugar and oxygen needed by these mitochondria to produce ATP are no longer arriving at the cell. And so the cell goes into this sort of total panic reaction. There are other ways. First of all, there's some energy, there's some food stored inside the cell, but there's no oxygen. But there are pathways. There are metabolic pathways, biochemical pathways, which allow the cell to burn a fuel in the absence of oxygen. It's very inefficient, but you can do it. So the cell immediately turns on these emergency pathways. But it's like, you know, you're out in this cabin in the mountain somewhere and it's very cold and you run out of wood that was stacked up outside and you start tearing up the table and the bed and the furniture. And pretty soon, you know, that can only go on for just so long and the whole thing is going to collapse. And, why doesn't the cell just chill? I mean, why doesn't it just sort of stop trying to make proteins? Why doesn't the cell just relax a little bit? There's one very good reason. It has to do with these membrane pumps. Now, membrane pumps are very important because, without going into too many details, the inside of the cell is so clogged full of materials that the effective concentration of water inside the cell is very low compared to the outside. So there's a constant tendency for water to leak into the cell. And so you need these pumps to keep pumping water. It's like sea pumps. You know, if you're in Holland and you're like 6 meters below the level of the sea, you've got to be constantly pumping the water back out. Also, there are ionic differences across these membranes. There's very high levels of calcium and sodium outside the cell, very low inside. Inside the cell, you have very high potassium, which is very low outside. And you need that electrochemical gradient actually to power the cell. So it turns out that the maintenance of these pumps is extraordinarily ATP demanding. It requires a huge amount of energy. Yeah. Try that. I mean, first of all, we're talking about a situation where a cell is in crisis. Why doesn't it plug its little holes? I don't know. I mean, I don't know of any way offhand that you could do that. Oh, yes. They're constantly opening and closing in a very dynamic state according to the immediate needs of the cell. But we're talking now about a situation where this ATP is shutting down. And actually, what happens is, they just become unplugged. I mean, you can no longer control whether the cell is opened or closed. They just go into this total collapse. And it allows things to then exchange freely across the membrane. What happens then is what we call necrotic death. It's a form of accidental death. And it's a very, very messy way to die, because as the water rushes in, and all, particularly calcium rushes in, those little organelles that I showed you, which are so nicely organized within the cell, just start to unravel. They lose their structure completely. This membrane, this plasma membrane, the limiting membrane of the cell, just bursts open. This thing just spills its contents out into the surrounding area. This causes inflammation. Inflammation, as you've all had inflamed portions of your skin or somewhere in your body. It's a very painful and very destructive kind of a reaction. So it's a very ugly and violent sort of way to die. And the important thing is that the cell is resisting this at every step of the way. The cell is doing everything within its power not to die like this, to reverse the process. It's not plugging up its little holes, but if it could, it probably would. But it's burning up stores of things that it shouldn't be burning up, et cetera, trying to make that energy. Now, for a great many years after people started studying death at the cellular level, that was the only kind of cell death that was recognized. It was just assumed that's how cells die. Of course, cells are going to try to do everything they can not to die. But about 25 or so years ago, some people looked at another kind of cell death. It's a kind of cell death that occurs, as we now know, universally in all living things all the time. That wasn't appreciated quite then. But one place where you can see it very easily is in embryos. Now, these are some artist sketches of developing human embryos. Here's a five-week-old human embryo. And I just point out the forelimb and the hind limb here, which are just beginning to emerge from the trunk of the body at this stage. Nothing, you wouldn't, it doesn't look like a hand or a foot, but it's going to be. So about a half a week later, 5.5 weeks, you see this condensation of cartilage here, which are going to be the future digits. The forelimb is always a few days ahead of the hind limb in development. But now you can sort of see something that's going to look like a hand eventually. Still looks more like a ping pong paddle. But at 6 weeks, you now see that you have separated digits. And now you see the condensation happening in the hind limb as well. Now, if you go back here, this webbing, if you will, this webbing between these digits is composed of cells. It's those cells aren't there anymore. What happened to those cells? Well, it turns out that the cells that form the webbing between those fingers at a very precise time in embryonic development die. But they don't die by necrosis. They die in a completely different way, which was not at all appreciated until these studies. What happens is that at this very precise point in development, these cells, just on the basis of a purely internal cue, commit suicide. And I don't like to use that term, but it's a useful one because it points to the fact that this is an internally generated program that they're following. They're not dying in response to somebody coming in and smacking them or burning them or anything else. They're dying because of a program that they have embedded in them that is activated at a certain point in their development. Moreover, the death of those cells, it looks completely different from necrotic cell death, which, as I said before, is a very violent sort of cell death. It's very interesting what happens. We know now in quite a bit of detail what goes on in these cells. The first thing that they do is they copy off one last set of instructions from the DNA inside the nucleus, and those are the instructions that program the cell to die. Then the cell completely cuts up the DNA into bazillion tiny fragments, which are completely useless, of course. It's like taking a piece of paper of instructions and tearing it up into a million shreds. It's no longer useful at all. And then the cells go through this rather bizarre thing, which has been called sometimes the dance of death. It looks like a Portuguese man of war. The cell starts undulating, its membrane starts waving around in the surrounding fluids, and little bits of the membrane begin to break off, and it traps inside of gets trapped inside these little bodies that float away. You trap the organelles. But if you look in the electron microscope at those organelles inside of these little bodies that are floating away, they're not torn up, they're not disintegrating, they're not compromised in any way. In fact, as far as we can tell, they're still functioning perfectly well. The mitochondria are making ATP, they're doing whatever they would normally be doing. Then what happens to them is that they get engulfed by surrounding cells, by neighboring cells, which sweep them in and then put them in their little lysosomes, those little trash compactors. And then, of course, these guys know that there's something seriously wrong with their life, but then it's gone. And so surrounding cells just basically recycle the elements of these fragmenting bodies. So that's the important thing about this, is that unlike necrotic cell death, where the cell fights tooth and nail to prevent what's happening, here it's actually the cell that's programming what's happening, and the cell is actively causing it to happen, not at all resisting it. Okay? All right. Well, this is just, again, that's just a sketch of the same thing. Here's a transmission electron micrograph of a cell breaking up. This is a process called apoptosis or apoptosis. There's like two schools of thought. It was actually interesting. The guys who first described this it was in Scotland, and they invited a classicist who happened to be next door in to look through the microscope, and they said, "What does this look like to you?" And he said, "Oh, it looks like apoptosis," and it's a Greek term which means the falling away of the leaves off of a tree or flowers off of a bush. At any rate, you can see these what they call apoptotic bodies breaking up here and moving away from the cell, and you can't really see it at this level of resolution, but everything inside of these apoptotic bodies looks perfectly normal. It doesn't look like there's anything wrong going on at all. And here's a scanning electron micrograph. Again, you can see these apoptotic bodies pinching off from this main cell. They'll in turn be engulfed by neighboring cells. But inside these little guys, activity is going on just as if nothing happened. So it's a very, very different kind of death altogether. Okay. Now, this is not something that's confined just to these strange moments in embryonic development. It actually is going on all over this room right now as we sit here. It's a perfectly normal part of life. In the immune system, for example, you crank out white blood cells, billions of them a day, and each of those white cells is specific for a different possible thing in the environment that could harm you. If one of those white cells encounters the thing which it specifically recognizes, it will then go into a state where it lasts long term, and that's part of what you call immunological memory. But if it doesn't encounter the thing that it's specific for, it dies. And the way how does it die? It does that same thing where it fragments its DNA and dissolves by this kind of apoptotic budding process. So that's going on all the time. In the nervous system, nerve cells shoot out fibers into their surrounding. If one of those fibers happens to connect up with a muscle or an organ that it could innervate, then that nerve cell is granted lifelong status, basically. But if the nerve cell fails to make a connection in 4 or 5 days, it dies. But again, it dies by this suicide mechanism. So it's actually very, very common. It's amazing that... Yes, it's enormously energetically wasteful, and it's a real puzzle. Nerve cells probably 80%, in immune cells probably 99.9% die without ever doing anything. But from the organism's point of view, clearly that works better than other possible plans, which may or may not have been tried. We don't really know. All right, so that's... So we know how cells die. There's two ways that cells die. Accidentally, a process we can call necrosis, or through what we call sometimes programmed cell death, which is apoptosis. But why do cells die? And is death an inescapable consequence of life? That's where we want to go. It turns out that, in fact, death is not at all an inescapable consequence of life. It is not a condition of being alive that you have to die through this process of natural death or senescence. Here's one of many, many versions of a evolutionary tree. I just want to point out that there are basically two kinds of cells in biology, prokaryotic cells and eukaryotic cells. For the first at least 2 billion years of the existence of life, which we think probably originated about 4 billion years ago, there were only these prokaryotic types of cells. Now, the prokaryotic types of cells today are represented by various kinds of bacteria, and then there are these archaeobacteria, which are these extremophiles that live down in sulfur vents at the bottom of the sea. But they're basically bacteria. And then about a billion or so years ago, we started emerging, the eukaryotic cells developed, and eventually we got multicellular animals and plants, which went on up somewhere up here to become human beings, among other things. Point is that for the first 2 billion years of the existence of life on Earth, we had only prokaryotic cells. Now, prokaryotic cells, like this is a typical bacterium, are very different from the animal cell that we saw before. They're extremely simple internally, very little there. There's DNA. It's usually a single circular piece of DNA, often attached to the cell wall. But you don't have any of these things like endoplasmic reticulum or Golgi apparatus or many other things. So it's a very, very simple sort of cell. These cells reproduce asexually by fission, simple fission. Each of them has, as I said, a single circular piece of DNA. That piece of DNA is first replicated, so you get two pieces of DNA. The cell swells slightly, pinches in half, and you now have two cells. Now, notice what's happened here. We've gone from one generation to the next generation, and nobody died. Okay? If so, where's the body? Nobody died. How'd they do that? It's absolutely true. In asexual reproduction, simple fission, you proceed from one generation to the next, and nobody dies. And in fact, that's how life was for 2 billion years. You take a single bacterium and put it in a flask of growth medium, and these guys divide around every 20 to 30 minutes if things are optimum, if they got plenty of food. As long as you keep thinning out the population, splitting it as it starts to get crowded in the flask, add in new nutrients, split these guys out, keep them moving, you will never, ever find a dead bacterium in there. Now, bacteria can die accidentally. You smack it with a hammer, it's dead. And there is a corpse in that case. There is a dead body. And they do that all the time. They starve to death. They get eaten by other things in the pond. But if you isolate them from accidental cell death, if you protect them from accidental cell death, you'll never find a dead bacterium. Another interesting little factoid: you take a single bacterium and put it in a flask, and if you did that with this little bacterium, in 72 hours you would have exceeded the biomass of all human beings on the face of the Earth. That's like 2 to the 412th or something. No, you can't. You can't. You can slow it down. You can freeze them. You can freeze them away forever, and they bring them back out, and they're just fine. But you can't. That's part of its life cycle. Yes. No, they don't have telomeres. Yeah. Well, this is a Gedanken experiment. You know. Yeah. Right. No, we're not going to try to do that. Actually, well, yes. As this DNA is being copied, there is a repair process that goes through, and if there's been any damage to the DNA, and I'm going to talk about that with respect to animal cells in just a minute. That's very important. The thing about telomeres is the reason that we have telomeres in our chromosomes is we don't have circular chromosomes. We have linear chromosomes. These guys were popped open, and to prevent the ends from sticking back together, we put these telomere caps on them, see? So these guys don't have telomeres. Okay, so, all right, so that's how bacteria do it. Now, if you remember back on that evolutionary tree, you go from prokaryotes into eukaryotes. The first eukaryotes were single-cell organisms. Multicellularity came half a billion years after that. Okay, and what I want to show you. Well, that's all right. So, yes. Well, sex, because bacteria produce asexually, right? Okay, okay. Now, when we get into sex, which happens only in the eukaryotes, okay, and it happens as it's one of the things that happened immediately upon conversion to the eukaryotic state of life, and there are many other things that happened, but that was certainly one of them, is the beginning of sex. Just as a simple definition, sex is nothing more than the exchange or commingling of genetic information between two genetically different cells, two members of the same species, but genetically different members of the same species, okay? And, okay, this is a picture of a paramecium. Paramecia are single-cell eukaryotes. They're sort of after that interface between prokaryotes and eukaryotes. They have this tremendously complex internal structure. They have a Golgi apparatus. They have all of the things. They have mitochondria and so on and so forth. The difference, there's one major difference. This cell is a million times larger than a bacterium in volume. If there's any trend that characterizes evolution, it's an increase in size. Why is bigger better? Because we're talking about a predator-prey relationship, and being larger than your neighbor is a good guarantee against being eaten by your neighbor. It also makes it more likely that you'll be able to eat your neighbor. So life in the pond was really a struggle for size, and cells kept trying to become larger and larger and larger. Now, if there's an advantage to size, which is that prey-predator relationship, but there's also some disadvantages to size, and paramecia was running up against those limitations. One is surface-to-volume ratio. This guy is basically just taking stuff in from his environment, foods coming in from the environment, gases are diffusing in from the environment, wastes are being expelled into the environment. And when you get to these really low surface-to-volume ratios, it becomes very difficult to take in enough food and enough gas to support life. So that size is a limitation just from that point of view. But there's a more subtle and profound and ultimately damaging reason why size is, there's an upper limit to size. And that has to do with the fact that you have a limited number of genes. As a single cell, you get a single set of DNA instructions. The genes in DNA code for proteins. And cells need a constant supply of these proteins to operate the cell. Structural proteins wear out, they have to be replaced. But you also have operational proteins like enzymes that catalyze metabolic reactions, help you digest food, et cetera. And these enzymes turn over very rapidly. So you need a continuous and rather healthy supply of gene products. And with only a single copy of the DNA, these eukaryotes actually have they're diploid in nature, so they have two copies of every chromosome. But that's just not enough. You get to a point where you can't make proteins fast enough to support life in a very large cell. And paramecia had run into that problem as well. But they solved it in a very very interesting way. Instead of having one nucleus, they made two nuclei. They made a micronucleus and a macronucleus. In the micronucleus, they have a single set of DNA master plans, whatever you want to call them, the one pristine, untouched set of chromosomes in the micronucleus. That's used largely for reproduction. They also made this macronucleus, and what they do is they take these Xerox off the chromosomes that are in this micronucleus. They make additional copies of them and store them in the macronucleus. The macronucleus is used to operate the cell. This is the place where the genes are being read off, instructions for proteins are sent out to the cell. These guys lie very quiet. They just don't do anything, okay? But here's where all the activity is. And the macronucleus is made from the micronucleus. That's where the copies of the genes ultimately come from. Now, this, by the way, is one of the really profound steps in evolution. It is the first place that we see the segregation of DNA into two pots, one that's used for reproduction and one that's used for operating the organism. Okay, and that has that turns out to have some very, very profound implications. Now, biologists who were studying these guys around the turn of the century noticed something very, very interesting. They regarded them largely as gigantic bacteria. They were single-cell organisms, and nobody was making this distinction between prokaryote and eukaryote. These were just big bacteria as far as they were concerned. So they tried the bacterial Gedanken experiment. They put a paramecium in a growth flask and to see what happens. And they start dividing, and they divide by fission, just like bacteria do. And they start dividing. But then after about 50 or 100 cell cycles, you notice something weird happening. The cells, they become strangely shaped. They get a little bit larger. They get rather irregular in shape. They start accumulating gunk in the cytoplasm, in the general sap of the cell, which sort of occludes the cytoplasm. The rate of division starts slowing down. It takes already a long time to reproduce a cell like this, but it gets slower and slower and slower. And eventually, somewhere around 100 or 120 cell divisions, they just stop and everything disappears. Unless they have sex. And these guys, in addition to reproducing asexually by fission, can also reproduce sexually by exchanging DNA with one another. If two paramecia have sex, the clock gets reset. And the progeny just start dividing very rapidly, very vigorously. They lose all of those characteristics of old-looking cells. They become rejuvenated. Okay? That may be the origin of the notion that sex is rejuvenating. I don't know. Here's how they do it. Okay, so here, I hope you can see this, but all right, this is a schematic. Here's two different paramecia, and I've given them black and white micronuclei, so it means they're genetically different, okay? So the first thing that happens is that the macronucleus and the micronucleus, which are most of the time sitting together in the cell, move to opposite ends of the cell. And then the micronuclei undergo a series of divisions. And during this series of divisions here of these micronuclei, the DNA is being cleaned up, mistakes are weeded out, corrected. Any mistakes or damage that has crept into the DNA is taken care of at this stage. You basically get down here to it eliminates most of these micronuclei that it's made, but it saves one of each, and then that one is again doubled. It seems rather Byzantine the way they do this, but it's how they do it. All right. Basically, you get down to two of these micronuclei, and then they exchange them. Okay, they exchange one of their micronuclei with the other cell, and this is the exchange of genetic information. Okay, so now they've got two different micronuclei here, one from each parent. Those micronuclei then fuse together to make a single micronucleus. And then what happens after they make this new micronucleus, which has now got the genetic characteristics of both, what happens is that then the old macronucleus dies. And it dies by that same process that I told you about before. It cuts up the DNA into 1,000 little fragments and just scatters them into the wind. And then the micronucleus is used to make a new macronucleus. But now the new macronucleus reflects the genetic composition of the new micronucleus that was made as a result of sex. And then this whole thing, then they move back together again, and you've got, and these are the guys that are now rejuvenated. Their progeny just start dividing like crazy, okay? So it's a big step from this to this, from that to this statement. But I would like to make the case that the death of the macronucleus foreshadows our own death. I think this is really where death started. Not necessarily in the paramecium per se, but in a situation like the paramecium where we're using sex for reproduction. Why does that happen? Why do I say that? Well, first of all, why do you have to get rid of the old macronucleus? The advantage of sex is that, remember I said that these paramecia start dividing, they take a long time to divide. Even when they're dividing rapidly, they can't divide as fast as a bacterium. These cells are a million times larger than bacteria. It just takes a long time for them to develop. So the time, the time between generations becomes longer and longer and longer as you go through evolution. And, I mean, for us, it's like 12 years. Okay. So the problem is that bacteria and fungus and other things that would like to inhabit our bodies is a lovely place to raise their own families, they're mutating, they're dividing and mutating every 20, 30 minutes. And they're changing their genes all the time. Mutations creep in, mutations can be selected by natural selection. They can respond to their environment very quickly. We can't do that. And animals after a certain point in evolution couldn't do that. They began reproducing so slowly that the only way they could scramble their genetic information was through sex. So the major end result of a sexual exchange is the creation of new genetic combinations that didn't exist before. Why do you want to do that? Because you want to give the organism an opportunity to create genetic constellations that allow that organism to compete more effectively in its environment. Okay. Now, in the case of something like the paramecium, when they have sex and they exchange and make these new genetic combinations in the micronucleus, it's not the micronucleus that runs the cell. If you want to test those new genetic combinations against the environment, you don't do that through micronuclear DNA. You do it through macronuclear DNA. But you can't have this old macronucleus hanging around with the old combinations, so that's destroyed, and then the new genetic combinations are copied off from the micronucleus, and that's how the paramecium deals with its environment genetically. So what happened after the paramecium? The paramecium couldn't get any larger because of that surface-to-volume limitation, if nothing else. The next step in evolution was multicellularity. The only way you could get bigger now is to go to multicellular organisms. This allows continued size increase. It has all kinds of other advantages, specialization of cell function. What we see is that the micronucleus and its DNA got compartmentalized in multicellular organisms off into the germ cells, which are the sperm and the ova. The heirs, if you will, of the macronucleus is the rest of the body, what we call the somatic cells of the body. We have germ cells and somatic cells. That really reflects the micronucleus and the macronucleus in terms of DNA. You see an increased use of sex, in fact, almost exclusive use of sex. But we also see now this process of senescence really coming to full bloom in multicellular organisms. So the problem is that somatic DNA that gets wasted at the end of every generation is really you and me. It's the parts we like best about ourselves most of our lives. When you're 18, it's probably a toss-up. You know? Right. There's all kinds of different patterns for handling that in different species. I mean, we have, you know, human females have a fixed number of reproductive cells, males don't, but in others, it's different in almost every species you can look at. As soon as there were multicellular animals, there was a segregation of reproductive DNA. That segregation that begins in paramecia is continued forward into all multicellular animals. The reproductive DNA is put in a special subset of cells. And the only function of the somatic cells, really the only possible rationale for the somatic cells is to enhance the possibility that the DNA contained in the germ cells is going to make it into the next generation. So all of the fancy things that we do ultimately has one goal, and that is to enhance the possibility of survival of our genes into the next generation. Yes. How do they decide to have sex, and why? I don't think that's really known. We know how in the laboratory to trigger them to have sex by throwing certain chemicals into their, like ecstasy and things like that. But how they themselves come to those decisions is not clear. No, but on the other hand, their clock is pretty well fixed. If they don't have sex, you can almost, you know, set it by your own watch, how they run down in time and get slower and slower. And we know that by a 100, 120, 130 generations, that the whole thing just falls apart and stops. Yeah? Well, these paramecia have molecules on their surface, which are like signaling molecules, and then other paramecia have receptors. And if you run into a paramecium that's displaying your own kind of mating molecules, you can't trigger that mating reaction. So it's chemically prevented from mating with itself. I think it can under extreme situations, but generally a paramecium would find someone who's different to have sex with. It's like, you know, well. Never mind. Okay. So, now I just wanted to make. We're running out of time. Okay. So, no, it's all right. That's all right. We now know that all of these programs are genetically controlled. This doesn't just happen by some kind of whim or whatever. But in all animal cells up through us, these programs of senescence, aging, and death are controlled by genes. And how do we know that? First of all, it's not controlled. There is no thing called a death gene. I mean, everybody gets into this thing about death genes. There are genes that work together to actually. It's not that they promote aging. It's that they fail to stop the damage anymore that causes aging. And I invite me back in the next millennium, and I'll tell you about those. But we can't go into that today. But these programs are all very, very closely guarded genetically. And it's fascinating that the same genes that regulate the death program in paramecium are present in human beings. You can take some of those death genes, or whatever you want to call them, out of human beings and put them back in paramecia. They function just fine. So this is a very evolutionarily old set of reactions that controls progress through the life cycle, aging, and then ultimately death. They're at the functional level. They're sufficiently similar that, I mean, you can take the genes, as you know from reading the book, Tony, you can take genes out of a human being and put them back in extraordinarily primitive little creatures, and they do the same function in that creature as they do in humans and as the natural gene product would have done in that little creature, except that you knocked out his own gene, and then you put the human gene in and show that it functions in its place. In human beings, there are many reasons to believe that these processes are genetically controlled. One of the most dramatic is with a set of very rare conditions in humans called progerias. These are accelerated aging syndromes. And here's an example of one of these progerias. This is this kid is 9 and this one's 11. There's a thing called the Sunshine Foundation. They get these kids together once a year, and but what you find is that the aging process, I mean, the loss of hair, the thinness of the skin, cataracts, premature maturity onset diabetes, cancer, many of these ravages of aging are present in these kids. They have with this particular progeria don't reproduce because they never become sexually mature. And they simply can't reproduce. They also die at about age 13 anyway. But one of these progerias, just a couple years ago, it's not this one, it's a slightly different one called Werner syndrome, they've now actually isolated the gene, a single gene. This is caused by a single gene that's gotten screwed up. What it tells you is that this does not that aging and death does not have to be a terribly genetically complex thing, because this is a single gene that does this. I mean, it's not every single aspect of aging is present in these kids. For example, they don't lose their mental acuity, which has its ups and downs in a situation like this. But probably 70% of the manifestations of aging and ultimately death are present in these kids as a result of a single defective gene. It turns out that particular gene is involved in unwinding the two strands of DNA, which allows the DNA to be repaired and also it prepares it to replicate. And how that could lead to aging and death, I think, could be discussed. But again, we don't have time here today. So I think it's very clear that that this program that's tied into sexual reproduction, the necessity to get rid of somatic DNA, is under the control of genes. One of the great things that's going to come out of the Human Genome Project is to get at more of these genes, like the one that's involved in this particular situation, sort out what it is that they all do, and whether or not we would want to actually act on that information to try to alter human lifespan is going to be, actually, it's a question we'll have to face probably in the next century. But anyway, not today. So today, somatic cells die because of the need to dispose of somatic DNA, as I said, unfortunately. The somatic cells are us. We're going to get a little bit poetic and philosophical here. It doesn't matter that somatic cells contain what we think is really cool about being human. That's not what nature is about. Nature is about getting that germline DNA into the next generation. All of this theoretical physics and immunology and crap like that is, you know, it's mental masturbation. Yes, to read, to write, to think, to feel love, okay? And now to get really poetic, in terms of the basic life process of life itself, this is just so much sound and fury and signifying rather little and maybe nothing. I don't know. Anyway, on that depressing note, I'll...
I know some of you have to go to a meeting in physics class, so please ask questions, comments.
Sure. Yes. That's right.
What
cancer cells. Cancer cells have achieved, they've reversed this, yes, yes.
Doesn't seem that there is any accidental.
Well, no, but cancer is a very interesting situation. It takes at least a minimum of 3 or 4 major classes of mutation for a cancer cell to become a cancer cell. A cancer cell is not a normal cell. It has mutated. We have all kinds of genes which in our youth protect us against things like cancer by in fact, when we're young and healthy and cancer cells arise, they end up, most of them, the vast majority of them, end up committing death, and they commit death, they commit suicide. They die by apoptosis. Okay. So we've got all of these safeguards in our cells which prevent them. And somebody was mentioning telomeres. I mean, this telomeres is one very good protection against the loss of telomeres as cells divide is a very good protection against cancer cells. So cancer cells are not normal cells. They're normal cells, but they've lost all of their safeguards that nature has put there to prevent them from dividing without limit. But once they do, in fact, they are immortal. There's another kind of cell called an embryonic stem cell that you can take from a very, very, very early stage of fetal development. And if you take those cells out and put them in culture, they, without any mutations at all, are naturally immortal. And you can grow those. They're effectively immortal cells, cancer cells. But for body cells that have become mature in the body, for them to revert back to a cancer cell actually requires a large number of mutations to get rid of those safeguards. Yeah. The next generation of That sounds good to me. Yeah. Well, now that we can clone, it could happen. I mean, now that we have the ability to clone individuals, we haven't done it with humans yet, but the technology is there. Yeah. 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 Yeah, and I could have looked like Cary Grant, you know. nature's less than perfect, you know. No, I mean it's you could think of one could think of other strategies, and we don't know what was going on in the world at the time these particular strategies were selected. I suspect that nature usually selects the cheapest, easiest way to. This other thing about you're talking about before, it's incredibly wasteful to throw out the nerve fibers, and 80% of the nerve cells never get used; they just crash. But we can't think of why that would be the way that nature went. Nature may get down some alleys, and it's more difficult to back out of that alley and start up another alley. It's easier just to go ahead and live with the mistakes. I mean, the bottom line is we just don't know, because we don't really know what was going on in the world at the time those mechanisms were selected. Yeah. Well, we wouldn't be sitting here if that happened, because of the old thing with, you know, put a bacterium in a flask and let it go without dying, and you know, could die, and it could starve to death. Again, I mean, that's, first of all, for other animals, yes, we can live with our young without necessarily competing with them. But think of many invertebrates, for example, that produce 50,000 offspring. That's a real problem. Of course, we don't do that. We've solved that problem by producing fewer offspring and spending more time with them, perhaps eliminating competition with their offspring. But most animals, in fact, vast majority of animals, once you get below the furries that we all like to watch on television, you get down to the lower animal kingdom. It's mother eat child. They compete very strongly with their offspring. Yes. Oh, sorry. Yes. Yes, yes. Yes. Yeah, and we thought, how do you do that with people? I mean, no, these experiments were done. If you keep, within any given population, there will be individuals who reproduce early in life and individuals that reproduce later in life. And this was done with Drosophila, with fruit flies, and if you just take late producing individuals and mate them, you eventually get in, you start, and then you take their offspring and you do the same selection again. Among their offspring, you take the latest reproducing ones and you keep mating them. And they actually ended up extending the lifespan from something like 23 days to 76 days. I mean, effectively tripled the lifespan of those. And that was not by introducing new genetic mutations or new genes. That was simply selecting the best genes in the existing pool. You can do that. You can almost certainly do the same thing with human beings. There's another strategy called caloric restriction, which has been done with mice and rats, where they absolutely restrict the number of calories that are taken in per day per animal. And there they've at least doubled the lifespan in these animals by reducing caloric intake by about 40%. You want to go through life like that, you know, constantly hungry and grouchy and irritable because, I'm sure you could do the same thing with human beings, but it's probably not going to happen. They've actually started these experiments now with higher primates who don't have any choice in the matter. But even those experiments are going to take 40, 50 years because these guys have longer lifespans than mice do. But the initial results of those experiments in monkeys, macaque monkeys and rhesus monkeys, look exactly like the rats and mice. So there's every reason to believe that if it were done in us, we'd have the same result. Well, I think the most interesting thing that's happening in these other countries around the world, you know, the projections of the United Nations and the World Health Organization up to 3 years ago was that we were going to just crowd ourselves right off the face of the earth because of the incredible birth rate, improved health, et cetera, et cetera. In fact, the latest projections are that we'll probably zero out at around 2044. we should zero out at about 11.5 billion people, and in, because the, calculating the, not just when fertility sets in, but for a variety of largely cultural reasons, people are reproducing. In the Western countries, we've been below the replacement rate for 20 years now, but it's the second and third worlds where that's been more of a problem. But even there, the birth rates are now falling off at a quite rapid rate. So that little sign that they have down in the Beverly Center, where, you know, how many people are being born every second, and it's projecting, you know, doomsday in 50 years, that's just not true, because at least the way things are going right now, the population expansion is falling off rather dramatically. But that's largely for cultural reasons, I think, rather than biological. Yes. Well, one thing about those trees, we always talk about them being, you know, around in the time of Christ and everything like that, 2,000 years old. But in fact, the cells in those trees, none of the cells in the tree have been around that long. They replaced their cells. I mean, one doesn't really know exactly how old the oldest cell in an old sequoia is, but it's not anything like 2,000 years old. It might be a... Well, let's work on it. I mean, we need you guys to join the fight here. Yeah, some trees do that. They replace them. Yeah. Some of them are. Some of our cells are cells in the gut, for example, and the immune system is, they're generating new cells all the time. But by and large, it's not staving off the inevitable for us. Unfortunately. Bummer. Okay. Well, yeah. Yes. Well, we have two copies of every chromosome, and then you have two strands of DNA within each chromosome. And so if one of those strands get damaged, you use the other one as a template to repair the damaged strand. Doesn't always work. I mean, we do acute, and one of the chief causes of ultimately decline and death is damage to DNA, largely through oxidation. That's another story, but take antioxidants. I mean, that's the bottom line. Yeah. Okay. Yes. And now I want you guys to all tell me about string theory. That's what I want to know. And now for something completely different. Yes, hi.
Hi. I enjoy this book I read.
Oh, good.
This one. Yeah. You write it marvelously.
Oh, thank you.
It was fascinating. But I have a few things. Structure is not necessarily, seems to me.
That's my book.
Maybe I'm wrong. It's not necessarily the definition of life.
No.
Because you can make most people say, you know, no amount of money to preserve them.